accession number 18613, reel 3.
Ross Edwards, reel 3. You were just telling me about comradeship in the forces.
Well, this is it. As I say, if you've been in the forces, then you really know what comradeship is. I mean, you go out on patrol, you've got so many people with you, but you don't realise. I was one of the lucky ones. I never came under fire on a patrol. But when you come under fire on a patrol, it's that comradeship that helps you out. You know that the person next door to you will do his best to help you. And this comradeship goes throughout the army, and I think you'll find this is why the BKVA and all the rest of it, all the associations, that revitalise it, because it's the comradeship, I think, that everybody goes after. Whereas you get a few friendships, but when you're in civvy life, but the comradeship, I think, is more when you're in the forces. And when you've been in close contact with those people over a certain period of year, practically living in each other's laps.
So, you were saying that you were never fired on when you were on patrol?
No, I was one of the lucky ones. Because I was in the head office part of the company, and because I filled in the done the paperwork and this sort of thing, I still had to be at the front line where the sergeant major was with the company commander, etc. But I got away with patrols for quite a while until the sergeant major realised I hadn't been on patrol, and he thought, well, you know, you've got away with it for a long time, Russ. It's about time you started and caught up. And that's when he started pushing me out on the standing patrol quite a lot. Because, yeah, I do realise I've got away with quite a lot. But when you're in the forces, it's a little bit of bullshit baffles brains. And I could do that quite well. And as I say, I was lucky enough to only cop a lot of the standing patrols from when he caught me. And I only ever did go out, I believe, on two or three of the other patrols. So therefore, yeah, I consider myself as one of the lucky ones. Because, as I say, you get so many patrols, but only so many people, so many times, make contact. When you think of it, there's quite a bit of no man's land out there. And you've got to meet the enemy before anything can happen. And, you can pass in the night, and that's it. You've lost it. But, on the other hand, if you get caught on the wrong side of it, yeah, you could be wiped out. So, I think I was very, very lucky. Very lucky indeed.
What do you mean by the phrase, bullshit baffles brains?
Well, any army guy would know the answer to that. If you've got a piece of paper in your hand, or a board with a piece of paper on, you can walk around all day long with a pen in the other hand, and nobody will say anything to you, because they think you're busy. If you've got nothing in your hand, and you wander around trying to look busy, people will ask you what you're doing. But when you've got a board in your hand with a pen in the other hand, nobody will ever ask you what they're doing, because they think you know what you're doing. And that is where that phrase comes from. A little bit of bullshit, and it covers. You can beat the brains any time. And, yep, I think you'll find quite a few people in the forces have used that quite a few times.
Were there many casualties in your company from the shelling?
Not a great deal from the shelling. As I say, majority of our casualties, as far as I know, came from skirmishes on the patrols. We were one of the lucky battalions. I say lucky. We never had to repel a full frontal attack. We've had to go in afterwards to let the troops out who've had the frontal attack, like we did on the Hook. But we were one of the lucky battalions. You see, just before we got there, they'd had that big push north to get it to the 38th parallel. When we got there, it was a static line. It was just like the First World War. You've got your trenches, you've got your dugouts, and you've got your hooches. They were all built. It was a static war. The talks for our ceasefire had already started prior to us being out there. And all the enemy were mainly interested in was taking one or two key points, like the Hook, which would have opened up the valley behind us to their shelling. Because we would have had practically moved back to Gloucester Hill, one of those where the Gloucesters held it on the when they were all pulling back under the Chinese onslaught. The Gloucesters held on to the hill to help the whole line recover before going forward again. Quite a few Gloucesters were killed there. But the by the time we got there, they'd got back up to the 38th parallel. And that is where it was more or less a static position. And because of the trenches and the hooches and the bunkers, it was so practically shell-proof. They even had the Remy go in on the Hook, and they slowly but surely they reinforced all the bunkers and reinforced concrete over there. They could only work at night and work in between the shelling and that sort of thing, but they got it all reinforced concrete and that sort of thing, which they had to drag over the top of the hill to put in place. And as I say, as far as I'm concerned, I think they practically fortified a hill to make it practically impregnable. Because, as I say, when the Chinese came at you, luckily I'd never done it, but they used to come in with the whistles blaring, the screaming, and they used to think that they could outnumber, if they outnumbered you about 10 to 1, they'd get through. But they used to lose a hell of a lot of men like that. Must have done.
What was your opinion of the enemy?
I had no real opinion of them at all. If they hadn't have been there, we needn't have been there, but no, as a fighting force or like that, anything like that, no, I've got no opinion myself on that score at all.
Were you there when the armistice was signed?
Yes, yes. We were on the Hook then, and that's where we spent the last 2 months. And yes, we were there when the armistice was signed, and the actual boat that we were supposed to come back on, can't remember the name of it now, but the actual boat that we were supposed to come back on, that one brought the prisoners back. The prisoners that were released from Korea, they came back on the boat that we were supposed to come back on, because you're only supposed to do 12 months over there, so therefore they'd already got our boat lined up to come bring us back. And we had to come back on the next troop ship, which was the same troop ship that took us out, the Halidale. And they brought us back, they didn't bring us back to England, I wish they had, but no, we stopped off at the Suez Canal then. We disembarked at Port Said and went to Fayed on the Suez Canal, where we were going to be for the next 12 months.
Was there much of a sense of relief when the armistice was signed in Korea?
Well, yes and no. When one thinks of the VE Day celebrations, and you're talking about a guy in a front line, you would think he'd be over the moon. But I don't think they were. Because the guy in the front line, he's living on his nerves all the time. He must be. You never know what's going to be happening. And to me, the first thing first, I think, yeah, the idea of a good sleep, I think, was uppermost in most people's minds. Because you can sleep, wake up, go and do some duty, go to sleep, wake up, do some duty, but you never, ever had that solid sleep. I mean, if you have a baby and you get so many disturbed nights and you realise what it's like. But our disturbed nights, of course, were a little bit more drastic than the baby crying. And it was more interruptions than anything else. So therefore, yeah, you were, I would say, tired. And I would say that the armistice brought you that, at last I can sleep. Or at last we can get some decent meals. That sort of thing. I mean, jubilation, no, I don't think so, because you've not won anything. I mean, it's not finished. It's still not finished. They're still talking, they're still argy-bargying, and this is nigh on 50 years after the start. And they're still talking about it, and they're still trying to get I don't know, something out there, but there's even threats now of another invasion out there from the north. So, you know, it makes you wonder whether it'll ever be finished.
But it sounds as though you were sleeping pretty solidly if even a stem gun didn't wake you up.
Well, that is it, but it's only periodically. You see, you get on your bed, sleep, boom, you're straight out. You've got to be. You can't leisurely lay in bed and have a natter and then think, oh, well, I've got to sleep now, because within 2 hours you're back up again. You're talking about a 2 hour or 4 hour period where you can have a sleep, and that's it. Then you're back up. So therefore you never get your 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours, you know, which people need. You never get it in one complete run.
How do you feel now about having served in the Korean War?
Now that I've come back, and now that I'm growing, and now that I'm enjoying my retirement, I would not have missed it for all the world, for all the tea in China. It's an experience. It's an experience that made me a better person. It's an experience that I believe has helped me to be more tolerant of some people. And it certainly showed me what true comradeship is really all about. And I think even the guys who went out in the Gulf War or out in the Falklands, I think those chaps would realise what comradeship is all about. But they went out, they'd done their stint, but they were doing their stint for the country. When we went out, we were the first fighting force as put out by the United Nations. And there was 23 different countries out there. And we were lucky, we managed to talk to quite a few of the different people from the different nationalities. The Canadians and the Americans and the other nationalities were out there. And, yeah, it was a very interesting experience.
What but impression did these other nationalities make on you?
Not so much an impression. It's a fact that we were all in the forces We all had a job to do, and we're all doing it to our best of our ability. And it was just a comradeship that if you were somewhere and somebody had got a couple of pints of beer, then, yeah, you'd have one of their beers. They wouldn't worry whether you're English or what you were. We were going up the front line one night, and I happened to be in the company commander's jeep, and the driver, because you get near the line, you had to turn off the lights. And we went for a roly-poly through a paddy field. Now, the driver got slung out one side, the CO got slung out the other side, because there's no doors on the jeep. And I was left to tumble around in the back. Now, when I got out and we hailed a lorry and got up to the front line, I got off the back of that lorry, and that's the last thing I knew about it. The CO asked me if I was all right, and I said, well, I sort of got a bit of gash on my leg, I can feel the blood running down. And he said something to me, and I didn't hear it, I just passed out on the spot. And the next thing I knew is I was back in the first aid station, back in the halfway house, so to speak. And I was black and blue from head to top, I bruised all over. So they sent me packing further back. And oh, it was painful to sit, it was painful to stand, I couldn't do anything. So they got me on these tablets, which were helping. But the other chaps down there, of course, they're all in the same boat, or worse, or that sort of thing. But everybody helped everybody else. And it's done automatically. You don't have to ask. And to me, no, the experience was one of really worthwhile going over there for.
Any other incidents that happened to you in Korea that we ought to record?
No, not really. Got blown up once. That was on 227. They used to have a 40-gallon drum of kerosene, where we used to fill our cans up from for the our little fires. And the Koreans, they had a direct hit on it. And I was just going back to my hoochie at the time. Yeah, the direct hit on that, and the next thing I knew, I was on my backside. And I thought, well, yeah. So what? Get up and get out of it quick. Because that was the first shell. And you had to wait for the next two or three, and I didn't want to be outside then. But, as I say, these are just little sort of incidents, so to speak. All part of life. When you hear the shells come over, you get out of the way as quickly as possible. But 9 times out of 10, I think they were more or less just coming over in batches, threes or fours. So as long as you just counted them, once they were the fourth one, that was it. They were finished, you can get out, see a hooch and carry on what you were doing.
What was it like in Fayed in the canal zone?
Oh, it was a nice peaceful station. Now, we were warm, we had to walk around in twos and threes, because at the time of that, it's more or less before the actual canal zone. They did have trouble out there in 50, 55, 56, something like that. And I believe it was leading up to it then. And we were told that we must go around in twos and threes. If you're on your own, you could be knifed. So you weren't really relaxed then when you went out of camp. And they had a nice naffy down in Fayed, down in the town, because we were just slightly out of town. And as long as you were walking around in twos and threes or a little group of you, you were all right. There was no trouble out there. The only trouble came from one of the other battalions out there, having to beat up one of our boys. So that resulted in a nice big punch-up in the local naffy. But
which battalion was that?
The Durham Light Infantry. they just followed us back out from Korea. And yeah, that's silly. But
did you get involved in the fight?
To me, it's all pent up feelings from what you'd had when you were out in Korea. It was a stopgap. Everybody, I believe, was drinking a little bit too much. And I think this was the cause of it. You see, whereas the Gulf War veterans or the Falkland War veterans were given counselling and that sort of thing, I mean, the First World War, the Second World War, the Koreans, I mean, there was none of that then. And as with the Falklands or the Korean War, the
Gulf War,
they came straight back and to Blighty after it, majority of them. But we hadn't. We'd gone straight to into Egypt. And I think, you know, that could have been part of the frustration with the drink and the punch-up. But after the CO had threatened to move us right out into the desert, that certainly quietened things down a bit.
Did you get involved in that punch-up?
But, yeah, well, we all did, really. The majority of us all just landed up in the NAFI. The MPs came along to try and break it all up. And then you had the Durham Light Infantry and the Royal Fusiliers taking on the MPs. And one or two of us decided it was time to flip and get out of it. It was getting a little bit too bad. And one or two of them did land up in hospital. It was getting nasty.
Did you get injured?
Yes. No. I was one of the lucky ones again. Keep on the sidelines as much as possible. And as I say, touch wood, I've been all the way through my life to 65 and I haven't even broken a bone in my body yet. Now, there's not that many people can say that. And I've led quite a life. But, as I say, that's the threat of being moved out into the desert, well, that was ironic. Because after our time in Fayed, they moved us into the Sudan. And the battalion was stationed at Khartoum. And one company, i.e. our company, B Company, was stationed right out in the desert on our own. So, yeah, we did get put out in the desert in the end.
Outside Khartoum?
Way outside Khartoum. I had to bring a lorry into Khartoum one day. It was broken down in a wagon. Because by this time I was an NCO, corporal. And I had to bring a lorry down into Khartoum. And it took us 3 days by rail to get this lorry from where we were down into Khartoum. So you can tell we were quite a distance away. And the railway over there was not very efficient, let's put it that way. We were on a open flat trolley with the wagon, and we used to sleep in the wagon and doing guard duty on it to make sure that nobody came along and started taking it to pieces, like, you know. But that was an interesting little trip. But as I say, this is what army life's all about. And it was from there that they sent me back to Blighty. I came back, sent me back to a transit camp in Egypt, where I was for, I resided one day. The following night I was on guard duty. And the following day after that, I flew home to England. 41 days demob leave I had.
Just going back to Korea, were there any other measures that were taken to combat the cold?
Well, yeah, the company sergeant major during winter, he used to come round with the naval rum issue. We used to have a little toddy of that in the whilst you're on duty. It was an exceptionally cold night. He'd come round 2 or 3 times to see you. Of course, there again, as I say, we used to drink quite a bit over there. And We used to get the Japanese beer, and that used to be in little sleeves of straw. Now, unfortunately, we generally used to leave it outside the hutch to keep it chilled, just up on top of the wall, like sort of thing. And when it got cold, you knew it, because all 12 or 24 bottles could all be frozen, and the tops would have popped off of them, and all you had to do was pick the ice out and lick it like an ice cream. And there certainly didn't seem to be much alcohol in them at all. But, yeah, good for a laugh.